This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper an author whose book I have just been enthralled with ever since I got it. Steve Kemper has written a book that really I wish every one of you would read. It is fantastic. It is called Our Man in Tokyo, An American Ambassador, and the Countdown to Pearl Harbor. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. Wow. This book is truly amazing, and one that I am so thrilled. When I got it, I sat down and started reading it. It is so beautifully researched, so beautifully written, and the story is enthralling. Tell us about this book, because, you know, yesterday was the 81st anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and there was so little coverage of it that I saw on television. Other than TCM running some war movies, nobody's talking about it. Yet what you've done here, this research into what the American ambassador did during those years leading up to Pearl Harbor, are just fascinating.
Well, thank you very much. I think you're right. Pearl Harbor, we sort of associated just with those images of the smoking ships sinking into the water, and that's mostly what Americans know about Japan before World War II began. And in fact, what the 10 years previously, the decade that I write about, is full of drama, chaos, violence, plots, coups, assassinations. Japan was a hot mess back then, and our ambassador, Joseph Grew, had to somehow deal with that, try to maintain our relationship with them.
Now, he is a fascinating person, and we are so lucky, and for you, so blessed, that he kept diaries. And this is a wonderful for people, you know, when you're doing research and you have the main character, he's kept diaries for you to work with. A tremendous gift, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. His diary just in his Tokyo years alone runs to 6,000 pages. And then there are, of course, all the thousands of pages of his dispatches back and forth to Washington, and all his letters and all his speeches. I mean, for a researcher like me, it was like falling into a beautiful chest of gold.
Now, he is a fascinating person. The entire family is fascinating, because when he was appointed in 1932, so he's right there, you know, in the hot spot. From 1932 to 1941, what did he see? What did he discover? Because most people don't have any idea what was going on in Japan or what led to the war.
Well, the military in Japan had these grand imperial ambitions to take over the Far East, to become the dominant power in the Far East, as Germany was proceeding to do in Europe. And the successes of the Nazis just encouraged this sort of global megalomania in the Japanese military, in the right wing. And so they kept pushing and pushing to expand. And there are good reasons for this. Japan's a small country, very resource poor. They needed things to fuel their massive industrialization and their war machine: coal, oil, rubber, tin. And unfortunately, the way they chose to do that was to conquer, to use violence to get it, instead of using trade, which Japan had done for the previous 30, 40, 50 years.
And they really believed that they could, well, they did. They took these countries, but they had this long-term vision that they could control these countries forever. I mean, where did this come from?
Boy, to go into the mind of a fanatic is a difficult thing. It came from their absolute conviction that Japan was the superior race in the Far East, and that they had a duty, a destiny, to rule over all of these people and all of these nations. And they got that idea partly from their excuse was they had a divine emperor, and a god deserves a large kingdom and deserves to be in control of volumes and populations of people. And so this drove them, as well as, of course, more venal things, such as they wanted power and money and influence.
So when Joseph Grew arrived in Japan, now he had already been in the foreign service for quite a few years. He was aware of the world situations. He was very intelligent, well-educated, but he had certain opinions that perhaps didn't go along with the standard Foreign Office ideas.
Well, that's true. I think that became a bit more true as the decade wore on and Grew got more and more frustrated with both the Japanese and with the American State Department. He was a good soldier in his own words, and so he faithfully conveyed our policies to the Japanese and faithfully gave information to the State Department. What he was frustrated about occasionally was our State Department's inflexibility, our Secretary of State Cordell Hull's seeming inability to recognize a diplomatic opportunity and seize it, instead sticking to his high principles, which Grew admired, but which got in the way of diplomacy, which is based upon compromise.
Tell us a little bit about the man and his life in Japan. Did he enjoy this posting when he first got it? Did he expect it to be such a long one?
Well, he did. He loved Japan, and he loved the Japanese. He said it was his favorite posting despite the failure. He said that at the end of his term. He found much to admire in the Japanese. Of course, there was much to abhor on the right-wing side. So he was respected in Japan because they understood that he was trying to understand them, that he wasn't solely an advocate for the United States. He was listening to them. He wanted to understand their position. And then he would tell them where their position had gone awry and what they needed to do to keep the United States from being angry about it. And a telling detail to me is an ambassador must entertain lavishly to rub elbows with people of influence so that he can influence them. And Grew, his dinner parties were almost always about half Japanese. And the other embassies in Tokyo rarely ever invited a Japanese to their dinner parties. Grew thought this was odd and not the way to do diplomacy. He wanted to fit in. He wanted to have personal relationships that would help him deal with the Japanese, that they would trust him, they would listen to him. And, of course, all this personal diplomacy, this empathy, it can't withstand fanaticism. It gets blown away because fanaticism has no interest in logic, compromise, rationality, truth.
Now, by 1932, when he arrived, what was, for Japan, how militarily were they advanced? What was their situation at that point in time?
They were probably, in Grew's opinion, they were the mightiest army in the world, still mightier than Germany, because Germany had not quite rearmed. It begun its rearmament, and certainly more mighty than our army and navy, which had been allowed to sort of lapse after World War I as we retreated into isolationism. So they were a big dog on a chain that they were trying to break, and Grew saw that clearly. And so did Herbert Hoover, president, who sent him there because he was concerned. Japan had just invaded Manchuria in 1931, the army, and the army had done that without first seeking permission from the civilian government in Japan. So that means the military is getting off the leash, and the civilian government isn't controlling them. So that's a perilous situation that needs a diplomatic response.
Ambassador Grew informed the President of the United States, well, during that period, that Japan was arming, and they were arming quickly, and they were very strong. Didn't this have any impact in Washington? I mean, in 1932, didn't they say, well, gee, let's start a military, operation here? But instead, we were just sitting back and waiting. When I look back on it and I see some of the films and how ill-prepared we were in so many ways, it's hard to understand.
Well, that you're going farther back into history. After World War I, we felt like we had sort of gotten sucked into Europe's war. A lot of people in America felt that way and wanted to have nothing to do with other people's wars, and that became our foreign policy was based upon that we are an isolated nation, and we will take care of ourselves, and we're not going to take care of you. So, a military response is not the best response. A diplomat like Gru would say we have to use diplomacy as our first line of defense and only resort to the military if it becomes necessary. Now, as the 1930s went on, and Japan started bombing civilians and also bombing U.S. properties throughout China, missions, hospitals, schools. Gru had a list, and by about 1940, when he handed that list to whatever new foreign minister he was dealing with, because he had to deal with 17 of them in those 10 years, that list of incidents against Americans was over 300 incidents long. And Americans started to become aware of this and get angry about it, naturally. There was also the Japanese bombing of a U.S. gunboat on the Yangtze. The gunboat was there to protect American interests in China. And Chinese warplanes bombed it, strafed it, and sank it, and then strafed the people trying to swim to the reefs to survive, killed a couple of Americans. Gru thought we were going to go to war over that. That was in 1937. So all of this was happening behind the scenes, and it was making the U.S. nervous and FDR nervous, and FDR responded by jacking up our program for the Navy in particular, and also for the Army.
During that period, the Japanese built a lot of ships. We didn't find this alarming, that definitely a military action if we didn't do something?
Oh, yeah. It was alarming, and that's why we were trying to build our military. But, you know, that takes time, and so we didn't want to have a conflict with Japan while they were clearly superior to our forces. Now, even Japan knew in their war games, they always lost after a year, maybe two. They would lose to the United States every time they did a war game. So that's why they devised this strategy at Pearl Harbor. We'll bomb them, we'll frighten them to death, and they will come to the negotiating table and give us what we want. We won't have to go to war, because if we do, we're going to lose. It's a kind of a stupid strategy, but that's what they chose to do, because they were gamblers and fanatics.
What was Ambassador Drew's relationship with the rest of the Foreign Office in Japan? Were all of the other people supporting his goal?
I can say that the answer to that is yes. He was very admired by everybody at the embassy, as far as I can tell. People wanted to serve under him. He was more or less a legend in the State Department, considered our top diplomat. And part of the reason that people felt that way about him is he would run his ideas by them. He would run his important dispatches by his close associates at the embassy to see if they had ideas, corrections, emendations. And that, of course, gave them they were part of the decision-making. They felt like they had a voice. And so he was very admired, and he got along with them well. He was a pretty good leader.
Well, tell us something about his personal actions in Japan. What are some of the incidents and some of the things that he did in Japan on a personal nature?
Well, one of the important things to me is, and it was new to me until I researched this book, was that in late summer, early fall of 1941, just a couple of months before Pearl Harbor, the premier of Japan, Prince Konoye, asked for a private meeting, a secret meeting, with FDR to try to come to some agreement to avoid war. And he offered to do this on U.S. property, in U.S. territory, immediately. And he had the backing of the Army and the Navy to have this meeting. So Gru, as a diplomat, was very excited and pushed this hard at the State Department. And he could never get an answer from Hull, that he could never get an approval for this meeting. There was... So that was one of the things he was most frustrated by. Hull allowed that idea, he strangled it in the crib, essentially, by making so many preconditions for the meeting that the Premier of Japan and the President of the United States never were able to meet to come to terms before violence occurred.
Well, Gru was an impressive person, even as a young man. Tell us a little bit about his earlier life.
Well, he was born into... pretty good wealth in Boston. Family lived on Beacon Hill. He went to Groton for prep school and then went off to Harvard, as his father had and his brothers had. And then he decided, instead of going into Boston business or banking, which is what his father expected, he said, no, those things bore me. I want a life of adventure. So he went to the Far East, climbed mountains, shot big game, hacked his way through jungles, got malaria, came home, and told his father, "It didn't change my mind to go on this trip, Dad. I still want to go into the State Department, not onto State Street." And he served in 14 posts all over the world. That's why he was kind of highly admired in the State Department.
How did Teddy Roosevelt hear about him?
Well, that's a good story. Gru was trying to figure out a way to get into the diplomatic service, and in those days, there was no professional diplomatic service. It was all patronage jobs, so you had to know somebody wealthy who would vouch for you. And Teddy Roosevelt, deplored diplomats. He thought because they were fat cats who didn't deserve the jobs that they had, he didn't pay any attention to them. And so he was ignored this fellow, a family friend of Gru's, who kept telling T.R., "There's this young man who really wants to serve." And that T.R. said, "I don't care. If he wants to be a diplomat, he must not have much ambition and must not have much character." But then this friend of the family mentioned to T.R. that in Gru's trip to the Far East, he had shot an Amoy tiger, which is a very famous large tiger in China. And suddenly, T.R. was very interested in this young man. Suddenly he had character. He had, you know, he liked the active life. And so the very next day, Gru was appointed to Mexico City.
It's funny that people don't realize that in those days, the diplomats did come from wealthy families. And there was a lot of this wining and dining business going on.
Yeah, just to cap off that story, the Foreign Service did become professional in the 1920s. Gru helped to bring that in, but of course patronage jobs continued. But the new foreign officers, he used to say, you just had to take a test. I had to kill a tiger.
He sounds, you know, so interesting in the book. And what as I was reading, I was thinking, how much fun you must have had with this one, because to have these diaries, to have this ability nowadays to do the research, and that you have all these things, and of course he was on the cover of Time magazine. His role is very important and fascinating. And the entire family, the Gru family, has been a family of great service throughout their time. And, of course, he was highly responsible for the post-war, what happened after the war, because he had, the right attitude towards Japan.
Yes, that's a good thing to point out. He served as the on the Far East desk as the chief of that desk, and then he became Assistant Secretary of State, which is second in charge at the State Department. And for long chunks of the last year and a half of the war, he was effectively the Secretary of State. And he tried to, he was part of the group that was defining the surrender terms for Japan. And he told this group, if we don't allow them to retain the emperor as an institution, not necessarily Hirohito, but the emperor as an idea, they will never surrender. They think he's a god, and they will defend him until the last stick is broken in the last child's hand, trying to stab an American soldier who is invading. So that was allowed to be in the terms of surrender until Alamogordo, when we developed the atomic bomb, and suddenly we no longer needed to invade Japan, and that term was dropped from the Potsdam terms, and so Japan didn't surrender until after we had dropped two atomic bombs on them. And even then, when they said, we will surrender, but we still must have the emperor. And Gru was part of the discussions that convinced those who needed convincing, let's let it stand, but he will have no power, he will not be a god. And that's when the Japanese said, we will surrender.
You know, one of the things that was so fascinating about the book is those years in Japan. It's a little bit complicated, but what you've done so beautifully, you've written about it, about the political situation within the country, different factions, different groups. There were assassinations. There were all sorts of sort of terrorist type of actions going on in Japan in those years that really lay out the situation and make for a fascinating story about this period. And I love this book. It's just, I kept thinking, well, there's a big possibility with this type of book when you find a character who's not known. You know, nobody really knows too much about him. He hasn't been portrayed in movies. He hasn't been portrayed anywhere, really. I was thinking that, you know, now perhaps either you could get a movie deal and write the script, because there's also a lot of tension within the book of what's going to happen. You know, we know Pearl Harbor's coming, but all the steps that lead up to it, you've turned into a really fascinating book, and I want to thank you, you know, so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's sad that we don't have enough coverage of Pearl Harbor, of what happened in Japan, because it's important. Well, we don't seem to learn from history, and there was very little coverage in the American press yesterday, which was a shame. Or even honoring the people who died in Pearl Harbor. There was nothing.
Well, I hear you. Of course, I agree with you.
There's a possibility here for a great, you know, maybe, I know you're not a novelist, but you could be because you're a great writer. Well, you know, you write this in a way that it's a novel. It's like, it's exciting, it's thrilling, and I hope that, you know, people will get this book and learn, maybe finally, I don't know if we'll learn from history, but you're a terrific writer, Steve Kemper. I want people to go to your website. It's stevekemper.net, okay? And the nice thing, you have the cover there of the Time magazine and a photograph of Ambassador. Also, a lot of your other work, because you are a fine writer.
Well, thank you very much. That's very nice of you.
Well, it's been a joy talking to you, Steve Kemper. You never know. You might write a novel, and you can come back here on Joy on Paper and tell us about it. How about that?
I would love that. Thank you for the invitation.
Okay. Everybody, get this book. It's available online. And go to Steve Kemper's website. Look at the photo of the ambassador on Time magazine. And check out some of Steve's other writing, because he's an excellent writer. Thanks again for being on Joy on Paper. Bye-bye.